Thank you, everyone who I can see, for coming once again to my last lecture. I think I've learned my lesson, and instead of saying this is going to be a low-density lecture and we have time to go around the room and everyone can say a little bit about themselves and I'll still finish on time, I'm going to say instead, I have so much to say, this is going to be so intense, but I think if we work together and we don't waste a single second, we can finish on time. So I'll try that. So I want to wrap, I want to bring this story together, this story about lattice models and topological quantum field theories. And I'm going to emphasize again, I mean, this is just me having, I'm just expressing some ideas and I'm about things I've learned about a proposal that Alexei Kataev made many years ago. So I might be telling things that are well known to others. I think this is a fruitful and fascinating relationship, and I hope to convince you of that too. So I want to remind you of the general paradigm, and that is we have some kind of lattice models, which you know consist of some Hamiltonians on a piece of space. And that's supposed to give us a topological quantum field theory. Which is something that when we're given a manifold, we make some kind of measurement. And the way that Alexei likes to say it is you think of this lattice model as a material type. And if you're given a manifold, an abstract manifold, you manufacture it out of this material type. So maybe I have to... So let's imagine we had to rivet it together to, these are rivets, not lattice sites, but it's not worth the amount of time it's taking me to draw them either, but I'm almost done, so why stop? Okay, so anyway, you have some abstract type, you manufacture it out of this material, and then you measure some of its properties. So in the sort of picture of the Bordism, TQFT as a functor, the sort of this manifold, this is the manifold side, and this is the material side. So somehow our abstract material type is supposed to live over here, and it's supposed to live in the material world. And that's where we want to do all our, that's where I want to do the sort of a discussion and the analysis of these materials. Now, I want to get a little bit organized. So let me just think about how this process has to work. If I imagine that my lattice model really lives in here, in this material world, then how do I get, how does this process really work? So remember this business where we could take Bord N and think of that as a symmetric monoidal category, and then we could form Bord N, what's called Bord N X, which is the Bordism category of manifolds equipped with a map to X. But this has a nice description in the language of symmetric monoidal categories, and it's the colimit over X of copies of Bord N, but another way of writing it, which is Bord N tensor X, where this means in the world of symmetric monoidal categories. So I remarked on that last time, and doing this in the world of symmetric monoidal categories lets you get local inside of X in a way you couldn't if it wasn't. Well, this makes sense for any symmetric monoidal category, and in the interest of time, I'm going to do one thing kind of quickly. So let's imagine now. So what I want to do, suppose I have in mind an N manifold. So in this picture, which I just erased, the N manifold was this abstract torus. And I want to, I want to model the process of I'm going to take this torus and this abstract material type, and I want to model the process of manufacturing the torus out of that material type. So the trick is to take X equal to M. So I can take board, and so I have a point in Cn plus 1. And now I'm going to just tensor both sides with this manifold. And now there's an insight here. There's something I'm... Inside here, there's the identity map of M. If M was of the kind of manifolds I'm looking at, right? These are manifolds equipped with a map to M, and among those is a map, is the identity map of M. Now that's a, I'm supposing this is a closed manifold, so that's a, you know, that's a, it's an N automorphism of the unit element, or it's something in, it's an object in loop N of this. So that's in that case, I'm going to take this map and I have a point in loop N. Loop N Cn plus 1 tensor M. Okay, and so I have this loop N F tensor M, and I have this point in here, which I'll write like this. It's the fundamental class of M, and it's a point in this. And then that gives me a point in here. Okay. So I didn't think to give that point a name. I just have some point in here. I guess I'll call it F of the fundamental class of M. Now, I was going to motivate this better, and I think in the interest of time, I think there's easier to process things I'm going to say later, so I'm going to just throw something that, if you're not familiar with the world of spectra and infinite loop spaces, this might seem kind of a funny thing to do. We have this collection of categories, CM, and CM is the loops, these are not necessarily invertible loops on Cm plus 1. And these are symmetric monoidal categories. And I want to collect those together and call this data, think of this data as some kind of spectrum object in categories. So I'll put a bullet there and think of that. And so this stands for all of this data. And then if I take C tensor X M here, I'm going to define that to be the limit as K goes to infinity of loops K, C M plus K tensor X. Okay, so that's just a funny maneuver. I'll give you a concrete way of thinking about this in just a second, but let me go down. Then this is part of what we would call C1 tensor M. And in this world, this C1 tensor M is supposed to be modeled by lattice systems on M. So more generally, C1 tensor X is modeling lattice systems on X. And that's one way the sort of world of lattice models fits in here. And I want to sort of distinguish the manifold side from the material side. And on the material side, this is where these lattice systems live. And if M is compact, then I could take the map from M to a point. That gives us this map. And that's by definition just C1, which is super vector spaces. And so this lattice model on M gets sent to a vector space, which is its ground state. So if this is reminding you of a homology theory, that's what it's supposed to do. This is some kind of factorization homology over M of a spectrum, not just an EN algebra. And if when you're thinking in terms of material types and lattice models and all that, the sort of manifold lives over here in the material world, and it behaves like a homology theory. It's covariant in proper maps and things like that. I'll give you one other formal definition, and then I'll give you one more formal thing, and then I'll give you a simple example that I often resort to when I'm trying to get my mind around where the indices and things go. So the simple example, the final example is, let's look at C1 of Rm. Okay, but I'm imagining. So that's lattice models on Rn, but I want this to be in the Borel-Moore sense. So I want to take the inverse limit of C1 tensor Rn. Sorry, that was supposed to be tensor mod Rn minus A, where A is compact. Maybe A is just a big disk going off to infinity. Okay, so that's the Borel-Moore version. And then what is that? Well, this is supposed to be, in that picture, this is some kind of lattice models on M, on Rn, which are allowed to go off to infinity. That's what this limit means. But what is this side? This is C, so this is a little formal manipulation in terms of indices, but the way, in fact, if you just chase through the definitions, this side is like C1 of Sn, maybe relative to a base point, which if you chase through the definitions turns out to be Cn plus 1. So these maneuvers I'm just putting on the board because this relationship between lattice systems and topological field theories is part of a story of thinking of these categories C as giving me some kind of homology theory. And it's some version of factorization homology. And so I want that influences my thinking a lot. It also influences a lot the nature of the diagrams we draw, and I'll get to that in just a minute. But so in this, in the material world side of this, this is the relationship between lattice systems on Rn, that's what this one always means, and n plus one dimensional field theories. So these are somehow, this C1 is built out of vector spaces. This is vector spaces populating the points of Rn with some data, and this is Cn plus 1. Give me one sec. So Well, let's see. In case these indices I think I'm just deciding whether I should skip something. I think I'm gonna. I promised you a more concrete way of thinking about this, but I'll come back. I'll bring it up if it looks like it's gonna come up. I think I could skip it in the interest of time. Okay. So I'm sorry. That was like saying I know something you don't know. I'm not gonna tell you. And but maybe I'll tell you later if you're really nice. But anyway, I don't. Sorry. There's a chain complex version of this. But let's come back to that if there's time. I'm kind of worried about running out of time today. Okay, so that's one thing. That's sort of one thing in the back of one's. You should have the back of your mind here that this relationship with lattice models is like a homology theory, and a lattice system on something is like some homology group in some world of higher categories. That's thing one. But now let's go back. There's another thing I have to do in setting the table. So we had this nice relationship. So we understood that the objects of Cn plus one, those are the same things as symmetric monoidal functors from Bord n plus one of some kind in the Cn plus one. But what about the maps? Well, I mean, a morphism in a category is a functor from a category with two objects and one arrow between them into your category. And so I could formally say a morphism is a functor from Bord n plus one tensor some category with just one arrow in it. And then if we could work out what the structure of that was, we'd have an interpretation of the objects, the morphisms here in terms of manifolds. And that's in principle what you do, but you have to set it up better, and this is also a beautiful part of a very beautiful story that Jacob Lurie also developed in this paper on the cobordism hypothesis. So in Jacob's version, you take you put you imagine including so the this The Bordism category of n manifolds into the Bordism category of n plus one manifolds just by not allowing Bordisms in higher degrees. You take a point here and you form the pushout in symmetric monoidal categories. Now, you can do this with classical Bordism theory, and this has an interpretation as Bordisms of n plus one manifolds with boundary. And Jacob shows that the same thing happens here. So this is some Bordism category of n plus one manifolds with boundary. And so if I have a map from here to Cn plus one, or any Cm, well, let's say Cn plus one, and I have a map from here, then a map from the pushout is the same thing as an object. So this classifies some object, F. This has to go to the trivial object, and the data of it factoring over the cone is a morphism from F to the trivial object, or from the trivial object to F. Everything's dualizable, so there's two notions. And so this is how mean, this is, may have already be clear to you from earlier talks, but so the we interpret a morphism from 1 to F as a left boundary condition. Or a defect to the trivial theory, we interpret a map from F to 1 as a right boundary condition. And I forgot to think through which is left and right beforehand, and there's two possibilities, and I'm a bad guesser, so there's only about a 25% chance that I've got these in the right order. But well, anyway, that might be wrong, but I think that's how it works. So there's two kinds of boundary conditions, but also in this category CN, every morphism has a left and a right adjoint. Everything's got adjoints. So you can get, so the left and the right adjoints give you of a left boundary condition or a right boundary condition, et cetera. So I think that we've heard of, and then another clever trick is that in a category like this with duals, I can always think of a map like this as a map from 1 into G tensor F. This is the stacking of the two into G tensor F dual. And so I can interpret a map from F to G as a boundary condition for these two theories. And this tells you maps from F to G are domain walls. And et cetera. So I don't think I'll spend some time. In my notes, I plan to illustrate that. But I think we've had a lot of much better illustrations than I will come up with. in describing what a theory with boundary, what a domain wall looks like, what a manifold, what a boundary condition is. I want to say things about boundary conditions, so I'm going to just stay in the material world looking at what boundary conditions mean. So I'll leave you to translate this to a physical picture. I'm deliberately not doing it, but the usual physical picture, if you have a manifold with sort of a codimension 1 or more thing that's decorated and labeled and the manifold's colored. And I mean, these were explained in other talks. So for my purposes, the pictures I'm going to draw wind up being different. Those pictures of manifolds and things like that are on the cohomology side. And I'm in the lattice world model, you're on the homology side. So my pictures are going to kind of come out different. So I'm going to draw, when we get to it, a different depiction of domain walls and things like that. Okay. Now, I also want to say a little something about boundary conditions. So let's remember in my talk yesterday, I was sort of exploring, you know, what is C1? And I said, there's one thing we knew about it. We can, we get a functor from that to the category of C0 modules, which is vector spaces, by sending X to maps in C1 from 1 to X. And that functor had an adjoint. There was a functor back. And I kind of wondered, is this an equivalence, whatever, but we eventually decided C1 needed to be super vector spaces. But anyway, so that's... That was part of that story, but I want to generalize this for a minute. So this generalizes, right? Cn plus 1 will map to Cn modules, Only now it's harder to say, I don't know that that's vector space, as Cn is some symmetric monoidal n category, and I'm looking at some symmetric monoidal n category modules. And I have a similar functor, which is Hom Cn plus 1, 1 slot. And you can think of this as associating to F the category of boundary conditions for F. And there's also a functor back, which, if you want, it takes a module M and it sends it to Cn, which is the tensor unit with M. Cn is the tensor unit here, so it's some orbit thing. And there's a bunch of finiteness conditions. I'm not spelling out everything here. We're supposed to be dualizable, so I want to look at dualizable modules and things like that. And I'm interested not in this whole category. So if I start with one and I get the free Cn module on one generator and I go back, I get one again. So there's reason to believe this composition of these two adjoints is the identity, that this winds up being a reflexive subcategory of Cn plus 1. And let me make a definition. So the image in Cn plus 1 is the co-localization of Cn plus 1 at the unit. Okay, I want to make this a little bit more concrete. We're going to do a lot more with this in just a few minutes, but what it's saying is it's picking out, this image is picking out a collection of n plus one dimensional topological field theories or n dimensional material types that have a lot of boundary conditions. In fact, they're ones that are determined by their boundary conditions. And in fact, so let me just abbreviate this. I'm just making this notation up on the fly. So I'm calling it the co-localization. Let's just say if F is in this image of Cn plus one modules, I'll abbreviate that by saying just that F is local. I don't imagine this term to survive the end of this lecture, much less go on and be immortalized as the thing that we call this forever and ever. I'm just making this up on the fly as a temporary way of referring to theories that have enough boundary conditions. So if F is local, then maps, this is just because these are adjoint functors, so domain walls between F and G, that's the same thing as Cn module maps from the category of boundary conditions for F to the category of boundary conditions for G. So that's another way of saying that. In other words, the domain walls between F and G are entirely determined by the boundary, what that does. If I have a domain wall from F and G and I have a boundary condition for F, I automatically get a boundary condition for G. Okay, so now I want to, maybe I'll do a brief Well, let me introduce one more abstract term, and then I'll do a couple simple examples. So let's pick a suppose I have a boundary condition for F. So that's a morphism from 1 into F. And we could think of that as a left boundary condition D. Then that has an adjoint D star, and I want to pick. I have this in my notes, but let me just see if I can do it in my head. I think I want to pick the right adjoint. It has a left and a right adjoint. And then I have a functor from 1 to itself. So that's an object, that's an element in HOM 1 1, which is an object in CN. And this isn't just this is a composition of adjoint functors. So this is a, oh. I wanted to pick the, did this backwards. Well, my star's in a bad place. Let me have my boundary condition go like this, and this, and this will be the left adjoint. I'm sorry. The notation will work out resembling something more. So now what I have is D star D. DD star mapping 1 to 1, which is an object in CN, but it's not just any object because it's a composition of adjoint functors, right? I can regroup these this way and use the evaluation map that the notation suggests to get to DD star, and I have now an algebra. So this is an algebra object in CN. And so I want to make a definition. D is a Dirichlet boundary. If the domain walls from F to G is the same thing, there's a natural map between these to D star modules in the category of boundary conditions for G. Okay, so. Now let me just do an example and connect this to the usual notion of Dirichlet boundary condition. So let me do that. Anyway, this is the notion. This is the notion I want to propose. This is equivalent to the notion Dan was talking about, but it's in a language. When I'm working in the world of abstract material types, I don't. Well, let me do an example and then I'll show you what I mean. So let's suppose, for example. Suppose n is 2, and let's just take the category of supervector spaces. So let's think of this as the category of C of linear categories, and we'll just take since I was saying everything had to be super, we'll take supervector spaces as an object in that. So that's the tensor unit in this category. And so what's a boundary condition for it? It is a supervector space, say V. It it's an object in that category, a vector space. And then the adjoint is, I somehow have the stars not in the right place, but the adjoint functor is sort of either HOM of V into your vector space or whatever. It's probably represented by V star. And I guess I want this to be like this. So my algebra A is end V in this case. That's not the usual boundary condition for super vector spaces, but that is a boundary condition. Any vector space is a Dirichlet boundary condition for super vector spaces, and the algebra you get associated to it is a matrix algebra. And you can check this condition that some version, I mean, it's Wedderburn's theorem in this case, but that to give a NV representation in boundary conditions for any other category enriched over supervector spaces is just to give a functor from supervector spaces to it. Okay. All right, so that's a little bit of the abstract setup. For some reason, I don't like I don't like to say that my category is A modules and then call A a boundary condition, because that's, you know, evil in the world of, in the language of, in the locutions in category theory, you know, evil. Do you all know that term? You know, if something's over-specified, it's said evil. Like, I mean, it's evil anyway. If you're lying and you want to say my dog ate my homework, but you say my dog was walking down the street and got distracted by this kid that was playing with a yo-yo and then turned around and ate my homework, you've been oddly specific about the information. No one's going to believe you, and that's evil. And in math, you know, if you over-specify, like if you say the set with one element, that's evil, because there's two sets. There's lots of sets with one element. They're not equal. Like if you said that, I would think, okay, well, there's the set whose element is you, and there's the set whose element is Satan, and you said they're equal. So therefore, you're Satan and you're evil. So I don't want that to happen to me. So I don't like to say A modules or whatever. I prefer to think in terms of these, that we didn't know it was A modules yet. And there's many presentations of vector space in that way. Okay. Oh, good. All right. I think I can actually finish on time. So okay. What I want to do now with this notion, and I want to make a proposal. So how do I picture all of this? Okay, picture. So if I take the homology picture, then if I have Rn, and I have some lattice model in it, so some bunch of sites and a Hamiltonian, I think of this as an n-dimensional material type, or this is an object in C n plus 1. So I can think of this, I imagine this is just an abstract material type, and this plane, this infinite plane, is manufactured from that material type, but I might picture that it comes from a lattice model. Then in this world, what's a domain wall between two of these? Well, I have it's just a, so this goes on forever. It's a connection of two material types. So I have one material type here, maybe described by some Hamiltonian H1. And another here described by some Hamiltonian H2. And these are supposed to be in some sort of renormalization limit that always keeps this boundary piece in sight. So that's a lot like the pictures being drawn except I'm in sort of the Poincaré dual dimensions. My material type, you know, this is sort of the thing that's associated to a point in your field theory, and this is a boundary condition, and it's so in a way, I don't quite get why, but the pictures I would draw to think about material types in terms of field theories are the what people call string diagrams, and as opposed to the other kinds of duality diagrams. So that might be, that's a picture of a domain wall. And so if there were just no sites here at all, I would just have a boundary condition, and I can just imagine that as a boundary condition on my lattice. Okay, so I want to connect this business to lattice models now. I guess I'm so tempted because I feel like I'm running out of material, and I could tell you that thing that I was going to tell you, but I'll tell you that thing a little bit later. Let me just see how this goes. All right, let's try to connect this to lattice systems now. So in a lattice model, so now let's suppose I have an abstract material type, and in a lattice model, I'm supposed to, around each site, I'm somehow supposed to get, if I really zoom in on every site, I'm supposed to get a vector space. And there's a way to do that if you just think about, if you put enough boundary conditions on everything. And in fact, right, in the if I was in a fixed point under renormalization, you know, and I started renormalizing the lattice, I would always just see a single vector space at that point. So I'm going to talk about a way that it involves making choices of writing down a lattice model from a bunch of boundary conditions in that you're supposed to think of as producing for you an RG fixed point. And so let's see how that goes. And so the abstract idea is I start with some abstract material type, and I pick a Dirichlet boundary condition. So there's the trivial theory is here, and my material type is living here. And then over here, I pick the dual Dirichlet boundary condition. So now I have some gadget here, and I didn't talk about this, but you can laminate these kind of things together along a boundary condition like this. So this, whatever this is, this is that thing I call D star D, or DD star. This is that algebra. This is a picture of that algebra object in CN, right? So you're supposed to picture that algebra structure as coming from taking two of these. So I think I have these in the backwards order again. I'm sorry. And laminating these two boundaries together. And I'll draw a picture of that, another picture of that in a minute. So you can combine those into a single thing. All right, so this object, this thing here in the middle is an object in CM. And so I want to take that object in CM. So I'm thinking of this thing in the middle as an object in CN. In fact, it's an algebra object. And I want to pick Dirichlet boundary conditions for it. In this category. And then that'll be some object. So that'll be some kind of object in Cn minus 1. And I want to go all the way down. I'm just going to keep on doing this. If this is finally the dimension of the Euclidean space that I was in, I'll get some object in C1, where I have all these boundary conditions, and that's a vector space. And I claim, and I'm probably wrong, I mean, I know this through examples, but not through a proof, that all of so now I have these different algebra structures, if you want. So I have these different algebra structures, and those can be used to make, you can put these on the sites of a square lattice and make this into a tensor network and write down a Hamiltonian. So that's an abstract thing. Let me just tell you a couple of examples that are kind of a proof of concept of this. So for one example, let's look at C2 plus 1. And I want to take the trivial abstract material type. So I'm just going to take 1, which secretly I know, I'm going to just say vect. I'm not going to worry about super vector spaces now. Let's just take 1 and I'll call it vector spaces. Even though that's evil, I'm going to call it vector spaces. And so now I need to pick a Dirichlet boundary condition. So what is a boundary condition here? D, that's a vect module. Or it's just a category, it's another C linear category. And I'm going to pick, I could pick any Dirichlet boundary condition. The obvious one to pick is vect, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take the vect crossed with itself n times. And the dual vector space, the dual boundary condition here is also vect crossed with itself n times, but they're in some duality pairing. And what's the algebra I get? So this is supposed to produce for me an algebra object in C2, which is C linear categories. What algebra object is it? Well, it's just, it's the category whose objects are n by n matrices of vector spaces. And the multiplication is just matrix multiplication where you tensor the vector spaces inside. So that's a perfectly good algebra, and that's the algebra I get. Now I have to come up with my Dirichlet boundary condition in the other direction. So I'm supposed to pick an object in this category. And I'm supposed to pick down here an object in this category. Well, any object will be a generator as long as I have enough of these. And I'm going to just pick, I'm going to choose a vector space W, and then just take the square matrix W, 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 W. I think I did this right. And coming out the other side, I have W dual. And what's the composition, right? The algebra that goes in here is the composition, and that's just W tensor W dual in every spot. So this is some object, and it has, it's ultimately something at the level of vector spaces, and it has a composition law in this direction and a composition law in this direction. And if I just write, if I write V for Cn, this is just W tensor W dual tensor V dual. And if you remember, in my first lecture, I gave an example of a two-dimensional tensor network where this was the on-site Hilbert space. And if you take the paradigm I'm describing and use these boundary conditions, what you write down a local projection Hamiltonian in on this tensor network, and that gives you this particular, the theory I wrote down. Those were also boundary conditions for the trivial theory, and so that tells you that under some renormalization equivalence, you can get this back to the trivial theory. So that's one, that's sort of the simple proof of concept, and it takes back to the hierarchy of examples that I was talking about at the beginning. You can write down these tensor networks that are supposed to represent all the examples, those examples I wrote about at the beginning, I described in the first lecture. So I have a couple of other pictures I want to make for you. And I was going to do another example. All right. Let's try not to waste any time. Let me think for a sec. What would be? So I didn't explain for you the Hamiltonian. Okay. So there's a picture which isn't a great picture, but I want to imagine, so I should draw this as a string diagram, and I'm just going to combine, I want to give you a picture of what the Hamiltonian looks like and what the relationship is between calculating the ground state of some system. So the Hamiltonian, I'm just going to draw a little picture here. All right, I don't know. Yeah, so that's supposed to look, oh wait, there's one other face here. Supposed to look kind of like a piece of Lego or something, or it's like back in this square I had it broken into four squares, and then I did an exploded view of it. So this is a combination of string diagrams and the other kind of picture. So this is a good picture to have in mind, but it's not the homology picture, or I guess you can think of it that way. But so here's, these are all my sites, and these are labeled with the different kind of boundary conditions. And as I pan through this diagram, these laminate together, and this gives me a map from, if you can read it as a map, from this vector space to this one, which is the inclusion of the ground state, or a map from this to this, which is some sort of projection operator. And if I took this picture and I glued it to itself in the other direction, or I'm sorry, I glued it, if I put another copy of the picture back here and I divided by some factor, that's up to scale, that composition is up to scale, the Hamiltonian. So in one dimension lower, it sort of looks like, I mean, if I had a big, yeah, the the local projection operator looks like that. It might be represented by a diagram like that, where these are labeled by my Dirichlet boundary condition, but it's not quite a projection, because if I compose it with itself, I don't get the identity. I get this picture with these glued together like that. So I have to divide by whatever the value of this is, and that evaluates to a number in the presence of these boundary conditions, and I have to divide by that. I have to divide by that. In the case of D by D matrix, if I took my vector space, my boundary condition, that number is like the dimension of the boundary condition. If I took vec and I took Cn, then that number is n. And it's somehow connected to the entanglement and of the ground state and all other kinds of things like that. So these models, to connect to some of the terminology I was looking for, these models that you get are always fixed points under renormalization. There's no correlation functions, I think. The correlation functions vanish identically, but the entanglement entropy depends on some number you calculate from this aggregate of boundary conditions. And I don't know very much about that. I've kind of hit time, and I wanted to finish on time, but I've been puzzled about something. I'm just going to throw this out as a puzzle. I hope just to think about it myself. But let me just do one other example, and I don't know if this works. I don't know what's going on here, but I'll do one other example, which is the toric code. I should be able to recover the toric code from the two category, you know, from that category vect G, the group ring of vect of G in categories. But let's just do it from this language. Oh, yeah, and see what we get. I'm sorry, then there's a comment I need to make. So, all right, so if I do that, so when I choose the first Dirichlet boundary conditions, that lets me identify this object, which was an abstract object in some three category with a monoidal category, which will be vector bundles on G under the convolution product. And now when I take this other boundary condition, so that's in this direction, when I take the other boundary condition in this direction, I have to choose an object in this category. So let's take the trivial bundle over every point in G, and then I'm supposed to look at and when I do that, I look at its endomorphisms. That's the ring of functions on G. And so I wind up with the algebra in this direction being the ring of functions on G. And so I can write down a tensor network. I have G many tensors here expressing the multiplication. I have two tensors with G indices expressing the multiplication in G in this direction. So this comes from this. So this bond comes from the multiplication. It comes from pointwise multiplication. So each bond has G many entries, pointwise multiplication. And this bond is the tensor I get by using the map from G cross G into G. Both of those give me tensors of the same rank. And I can write this down, and I get a tensor network, and I get a local projection Hamiltonian. And this is what I would get for the toric code if I chose these boundary conditions. But this is not the toric code. I mean, our G is Z2. This is not what the toric code is. The toric code isn't a tensor network in this sense. It doesn't have, in the toric code, you have operators here, you have operators here, here, and then there's an operator on these sites as well. And so it doesn't factor as a tensor network in this same way. And there must be something that renormalizes down to both of those. And I don't know how to construct it. I've been puzzling over that for the last few days. If anybody's interested in discussing that, I'm here for another hour and a half. We can do that. Okay, and I want to make one other comment about this, and I'm just going to leave it at that. When I'm writing down these cubes, the nature of the boundary condition on each of the faces is different, right? On these sides, it was a boundary condition on, it was a defect, right? On this side, it was a defect between defects. And on the other side, it was a defect between defect between defects. So this is a string diagram kind of picture and not the usual picture. And I say that because just for category reasons, the symmetry has been completely broken. Right, the faces, I can't rotate this picture. The faces, the terms on the different faces have completely different meaning. But that doesn't mean that the topological quantum field theory can't have those symmetries. So I forgot to say that when I was setting this whole thing up. The symmetries, the ON action on a topological field theory comes from these, it comes from the fact that the free thing on a point is a point, you know, with an n framing or an n plus one framing or something. And that action, so that's an action on each of these Cn's. So there's an On action here, which doesn't necessarily have to have anything to do with the obvious On action here. So the topological field theory that comes from a lattice system, even though the lattice system can look terribly non-symmetric, the emergent field theory could be spin or whatever invariant. And it's one of the challenges in understanding that is to try and understand that's a challenge in understanding that. So if I was to really try to identify these things, so I hope I've given you some way that you might get a lattice model out of some topological field theories, and we hope there's a way of getting topological field theories out of lattice models. I just have some executive points to make at the end. So one is, I should have said this owes a lot to some construction of Dan Fried and Constantine Telemann in the StatNet case, where they wrote down some lattice models for, I think it was Taraia-Vero theories. So there's acknowledgement there. So I have a couple of sort of closing remarks. So one thing is, we have the sort of lattice systems as material types. They're supposed to correspond to topological quantum field theories, or at least scaling limits of lattice systems. But in the world of lattice systems, there's all these things we don't know. You know, we don't know what happens if it's gapped, and if the gap remains under renormalization, if that implies exponential decay of correlations, whatever. We don't know. There's some kind of finiteness condition that we don't know how to look at the Hamiltonian in the system and make a calculation and know what satisfies that finiteness condition. But the ones that do, whatever that is, those are the ones that probably have emergent topological quantum field theories. Over in the world of topological quantum field theories, we're looking at objects that have Dirichlet boundary conditions all the way down. I don't know how to single out that class of objects by any measurement I might make. So I think of this as isolating a convenient class of topological field theories and a convenient class of lattice models. And it's like when we do algebraic topology, we work with CW complexes or simplicial complexes. We don't really want to think about the Sierpinski gasket or some other space that, when we're computing, we tend to think of more reasonable spaces. But we don't have, there are criteria for a space to be in a CW complex, but they're not always easily verified criteria, and they're not of the form of you calculate some global measurement and you learn that it's a CW complex. So I think it's very interesting to answer these questions about how would you know a lattice system has this sort of nice scaling properties, or how do you know a topological quantum field theory has a lot of boundary conditions. But I don't know that those are the, it might be that we're just supposed to take that as a good class of things, like CW complexes are a good class of things. And in fact, already buried in this is a story like that. The cobordism hypothesis itself expresses an elaborate, highly elaborate finiteness condition that's very hard to work out in concrete terms as you go in, increase category level. But we've learned to just accept that that's, that, you know, fully dualizable is a good thing. And the situation here is, I think, in a way the same, that there's emerging on both sides is an interesting discreteness condition or something like that. And I think, you know, maybe part of, I think, what I think this is, if there's something in this, one of the things is just isolating this interesting discreteness condition. And then, oh boy, so last thing, just last executive comment. How are you actually going to prove these are the same? And the only strategy I can really think of is to take lattice models of the kind I drew and domain walls of the kind I drew and all of this and try to make those into a infinity n category with duals. And that's the only, I mean, I love checking these examples with each other, but really what we'd like to just take one or scaling limits of lattice models and make that into an infinity n category with duals. And that's, you know, in the invertible case, that's what Kataev did that started a lot of this off. He showed that the invertible ones did form an infinite loop space and made a conjecture about what it was. All right, I'm going to stop there. Thank you for listening. I hope you've learned something. I know I have. So thank you. And sorry about that thing I didn't tell you. So, okay. You don't have to, I'll tell you the thing. No, that'll take a few minutes. I'll tell you over lunch. But who's running this? I am? Okay, are there any questions? Are there any questions online? All right, well, let's thank the speaker again. Thanks for listening, everybody. I look forward to seeing you again at some other meeting.